The sermon is God's call for purity in Christian leadership.
What does true revival look like?
I felt like the Lord began to speak to me. I'll explain what happened. This picture that you're seeing up here is a picture of Gregory Peck, right? And this is the 1951 movie David and Bathsheba, starring Gregory Peck, Susan Hayward. The scene is when King David first spots Bathsheba bathing as he walks in the evening on the roof of his palace. It is the moment that the lust of the eyes entices him initially, and he ends up falling. Now, not off the roof, but in a different way. Now, as we will see this morning, there are many small kind of failures, actually, that precede this moment, that led up to this moment. But it is here, at this moment, that temptation truly takes root in his heart, and it leads to what I think can only be described as kind of the quintessential sexual failure of leadership in the Bible. And so when I wanted to talk about this subject, I thought we need to look at this story of David and Bathsheba, and we're going to do that. But what brought it about was recently I heard, it was actually at the Vineyard Pastors Retreat, I heard of another mega church pastor who was caught in an adulterous relationship. You can look, get to the next slide. It's Bruxy Cavey. Do you guys know who Bruxy Cavey is, any of you? Yeah, but he's actually the senior pastor of one of the fastest growing and most influential churches in Canada. He stepped down now, but he was the champion of what he called authentic relational Christianity. He was an evangelical in his own theology. He's famous for kind of having this third way in which he didn't embrace, let's say, progressive Christianity, but he welcomed everybody to come in and discuss things and so on. He challenged what many would consider to be the unbiblical ideas of some of the conservative Bible Belt Christianity, things like an overzealous nationalism. He is a Mennonite pacifist. He also opposed any kind of legalistic or unloving posture to those who disagree with us or with Christian ideas. He would often invite them to come in, and he wanted them to speak so that we wouldn't get like an unbalanced view of what they actually teach and things like that. And so in many ways, he was the hero of what I would call kind of young adults who had grown up in the church but were now disillusioned with the church. So he was kind of their champion, and so many, many young people were attending this church that he was a part of. You can look at him. He kind of looks like somebody that young people would, you know, there's nothing. He joked that he says, "I have Jesus' face and Buddha's body." But if you look at his arm there, he's stretching out his arm, and it's I think of Leviticus 19:28 is tattooed on his arm. Do you know what that is? That's the place in the Old Testament where it says, "Don't tattoo your body." So that's kind of the way he is, right? He's like challenging these ideas, and so young people thought he was the coolest thing. And yet, he was their hero, but in what's happened, so he's kind of anti all of the things that we would normally think of a, you know, the fallen evangelical televangelist. He's not like that. And yet, he too fell. Now, there are a lot of theological areas that I totally disagree with Bruxy on. I'm not as big a fan as some people are. But my point is that when I heard that he had fallen sexually, and then I thought about Rabbi Zachariah's sexual fall, I thought about Bill Hybels, I don't know if you know him, but sexual fall. Then there was Carl Lentz recently, who is from Hillsong. He was the pastor of the L.A. Hillsong, where Justin Bieber was attending, and he had multiple affairs, apparently. And now even Brian Houston, who is Hillsong's founder, has also stepped down from leading all of Hillsong because of inappropriate sexual conduct with two women that came forward. I felt like God said something in my spirit. And it's kind of this. And believe me, I'm going to show you a slide of a bunch of people that have fallen. But anyway, I'm not judging these people. There's a part of me that realizes that I'm as susceptible as anyone else. Beware the man who thinks he stands, lest he fall. And these temptations are common to all of us, but there is something that the Lord is saying to us, and it's this, you know, this has to stop. Enough is enough. And I know, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, I've got this somewhere else in my sermon, so if I say it later on, just remind me. But here's what he's also said to me. He said, you know, I am pouring out my spirit. I want a revival to come. I want a renewal to come. And I will do it even in this church. I will pour. And we shouldn't look at it and say it's going to happen here and we're going to be the epicenter of it. I think that's pride. And pride is one of the things that I'll talk about that leads you to this down this path. But I felt like the Lord said to me, if you want to know what true revival is, it's not necessarily the outpouring of my spirit, as good as that is, and I want it. It's not necessarily healing, as good as that is, and I want it. It's not even prophetic words that are accurate and true, as good as those are, and we want them. It's when this stuff stops. That's revival. It's when something transforms our hearts so that this stuff seems like it's the last thing we want to do. And this stuff has happened. It's crossed all kinds of denominational lines. Let's look at it. As I heard about Bruxy in Princeton when I was there, all of a sudden I kind of got this video of this slideshow of all of these pastors, and I'm going to try and recreate that for you so you can feel as horrible as I did. So let's look at it together. The first one was Bruxy Cavey. There he is. But if you're old like me, you'll remember probably they called him Jim Baker, was probably the biggest evangelical leader in his day at that time in the 70s and 80s. And he fell. And one of the things I'll tell you, this is not even including the people who have fallen from monetary issues, fraud, those kinds of things, or, you know, fallen for any other reason. There's power struggles, all those kinds of things. No, this is only for sexual sin. So Jim Baker, he had an affair with his secretary, and she later on exposed the whole thing. You guys all know Jim Swaggart. One of the things also, I had pictures initially of Jim Baker getting taken to jail and Jimmy Swaggart crying. If you remember his confession, if you're old like me, you will remember it. The Lord told me, I felt like, he said, don't do that. I want you to put the best picture up on them, of them, because I don't want you to make fun of them. Because this isn't about judging these people. This is about the reality that it's possible for any of us to fall in this area, and how God is actually saying, I want the church to take it serious inward and to deal with the things in their own heart. Okay, so anyway, Jimmy Swaggart, who I remember at the time, you know, he was the biggest. He was bigger than Billy Graham when he fell. He was getting hundreds of thousands of people out to his crusades all the way through North America. Into South America, he had some of the biggest crusades, more people coming to Christ through his, and of course we know he ended up sinning with prostitutes, and he was addicted as well to pornography and so on. So Ted Haggard, do you know, who knows who Ted Haggard is? You guys don't know anybody. Ted Haggard was the head of the evangelical church in America, for goodness sake. Now, he was Pentecostal, but he had, again, a massive church, but he was over top of the whole of the evangelical fellowship of the United States. And he ended up, he was in both homosexual relationship with AIDS, so not AIDS as in the sickness, but with the people that work for him, exactly. And he also would take meth at the same time that he was having these affairs with these men. Jerry Falwell Jr. Also became one of the, probably the highest or leader of the evangelical movement in the United States just a few years ago. He was considered the primary person that got Trump elected. He galvanized the evangelical vote in the States, and it was around this idea of morality and so on. He is, of course, the son of Jerry Falwell that started Liberty University. He was the president of Liberty University at the time, and Jerry Falwell Jr. came out that his wife was having an affair with a younger man, but Jerry knew it and he encouraged it, and he would often participate. So it was sort of this open marriage thing that was going on. Let's look at the next one. Bill Hybels. How many of you know who Bill Hybels is? He was one of my heroes. Willow Creek. He started Willow Creek Church, but then he started the Willow Creek Association. And I'll tell you this, the way in which he understood church growth was amazing. The biggest churches were associated with the Willow Creek Association. And he started the biggest global leadership summit, Christian leadership summit in the world. Everyone attended it. He was one of the great Christian leaders, spoke all over the place. Not necessarily charismatic either. He's more just evangelical conservative. But again, he was found out that he was having relationships with women. There was a woman who, again, was on staff that he had a sexual relationship with. He did all kinds of inappropriate things with women that came out later. He ended up stepping down as well in disgrace. We all know about Ravi Zachariah, one of the greatest teachers, biblical teachers in my mind, out there. And yet he was exposing himself to the massage therapist that was, he actually owned some of the massage parlors because he had a bad back and that, but he would expose himself to them. He would demand that they relieve him, all those kinds of things. So he died before a lot of this revelation came out, but he had inappropriate video relationships with women, all kinds of stuff that came out. And again, really destroyed his legacy, didn't he? In some ways, right? I don't know if you know who Todd Bentley is. Todd Bentley might be more known in our circles because he was connected slightly with Renewal, with all of that. He started the Lakeland Revival, which actually got so much attention. ABC News, NBC News, all of them went down there because there was apparently tons of miracles that were happening in Lakeland, Florida. And his profile went way up. But even in the midst of that revival, he was having an affair with a woman on staff. He ended up leaving his wife for her. But even after that, him and this new woman have this really weird relationship where they started inviting other people into the room. Just a mess. Have you guys seen enough? Paul Cain, a recent him up there, went to tons of Vineyard Conference, a prophetic guy. Again, he ended up having a drinking problem where he would get drunk all the time, and he had homosexual relationships with staff members. So he had that problem, and that came out. Let's look at the last one. Slide, if we can. Bob Coyd, I don't know if you know him, but he was a Calvary Chapel pastor, 25,000 people in his church, and just about, I think it would have been 7 years ago, it came out that he was having multiple affairs. Later on, he's now been charged with molestation of a minor.
So there you go. Bill Gothard. But you know, who has some Baptist roots? How many of you know who Bill Gothard is? Bill was like the ultra-conservative. And he had this huge ministry that spanned across all kinds of churches where he talked about wives submitting to their husbands and godly children. And it was massive. He had a Learjet and would fly all over the place as well. Well, it came out later that he had inappropriate relationships with a woman on staff, and now he's also been accused of and had to step down from the whole ministry. I think he might be dead now, but anyway, he molested some teenagers as well. Carl Lentz, you know who Carl Lentz is? He's the Hillsong pastor of that big church that I talked about where Justin Bieber's down in L.A. Again, it was just growing, and it was impacting Hollywood, and all kinds of people were going to it. God was being glorified. And how many of you love Hillsong music? I mean, is it anointed? It's amazing, right? And he was one of the big, you know, leaders of this movement, and they found out he had multiple affairs with different women. And now, as I said earlier, Brian Houston, who was the founder of Hillsong in Australia, and he's in trouble as well for not multiple affairs, but there was some conduct that was inappropriate with women on his staff. He also is in trouble because they say he covered up the fact that his father had molested a 14-year-old girl. And he denies it. But that is something that is. So how many of you feel like this has to stop? See, these aren't just small leaders. These are significant leaders. These are actually the leaders that are leading the major blocks of the Christian church, the evangelical Christian church in North America. They're the leaders of leaders, absolutely. And this list is no way exhaustive. It doesn't include all those other ways that people fall. It also doesn't include the lesser known pastors and leaders who have fallen. Many of you could probably name people in Campbell River, pastors or youth pastors who have fallen sexually. And this list crosses denominational lines. It crosses theological lines. It includes Baptists, Pentecostals, conservatives, liberals, intellectuals, non-intellectuals. This is not a theological issue. This is not, if you believe the right things, then you will act more godly. No, this is an issue that attacks the whole church and actually the non-churched as well. So it's not just the church where sexual sin happens and these kinds of things happen. Many of these people are terrific Bible teachers. It doesn't negate the teaching even that they did. No, this is an issue primarily of the heart. It's an issue of what we love or what we allow to dwell within our hearts. In 1 John 2:15, 17, it says this: "Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him." Now, I want to be careful here. It doesn't mean that if you've sinned in this way that you don't have the Father in you, that you never were a believer or a Christian. His point here is if your heart is captured totally by the world, then you need to get that out of you. The love of the Father is not the ruling thing in your life. And that ultimately is the issue. For everything in the world, the cravings of sinful man, which is the cravings of the flesh, is another translation of it, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, or in this translation, the boasting of what he has and does, comes not from the Father, but from the world. The world and its desires pass away, but the man who does the will of God lives forever. And this is, I believe, the real issue. Especially when we're talking about high-profile leaders that fall. The cravings of the sinful man or the flesh. If you remember from our series on the Gospel Essentials, When you become a believer, it's true that the sinful nature, the flesh, is put to death. God puts it to death. There is a sense in which it's already done. But we talked about the fact that we are still prone to our old habitual sinful patterns. In one sense, what happens when you become a believer is you don't have an excuse anymore. See, before you know Christ and the Spirit is put in you, in one sense, you're powerless to live the way God wants you to live because you need God to live the way God wants you to live. Amen? But what happens when you become a believer is that nature is put to death and the Spirit of God now comes and dwells within you. But in one sense, that really should tell us that we, above everyone else, have the power to live differently. Now, that doesn't mean it's easy. That doesn't mean that you won't be tempted. But those old sinful patterns and old ways in which we used to deal with our pain and our dysfunction still can happen in our life. And if we don't believe that, if we don't know that, that's part of the problem. If we think we're above it, that's part of the problem. As a believer, we must not let our sexual desires rule over us. The lust of the eyes is related to the first thing, this sinful cravings, but it is specifically about what we look at. What am I looking at that captures my heart? And this can either be the physical form of like women or men. Women can have the same thing. Or it can be material possessions, what we covet. It's the things that are not ours to have that we want to have. And finally, the pride of life or ego, the love of position, the love of power, the love of importance. When we as leaders begin to believe our own press releases, when leaders forget who is supposed to get the glory and why God has gifted them and given them a platform in the first place, that's the pride of life. And I think these three things are so evident in most of the stories of the leaders in those slides that we just looked at. But why? And how do these three temptations of the world take hold of so many gifted Christian leaders? And to see this, we're going to look now at the story of David and Bathsheba. And to do that, we're going to look at 2 Samuel 11, and we'll start with 1 to 5 here. And it says this, in the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbath, but David remained in Jerusalem. Now that's his first problem. I'll get to that. Now one evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. And David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "Isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. She had purified herself from her uncleanness. Then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David saying, "I am pregnant." Now I've had this, and when she purified herself from her uncleanness, she returned to her house. I just want to kind of say there's this idea of what is that thing? When she had purified herself from her uncleanness, or she had purified herself from her uncleanness. There's a debate in theological circles about what this is all about. Is it talking about why she was bathing in the first place? So if she had had her menstrual cycle, she had to do a cleansing thing. If you know the Old Testament, there's a cleansing process in which they'll be unclean for 7 days after they've had their menstrual cycle. So most scholars and a lot of translations you'll read will say she had purified herself from her menstrual cycle. But a lot of scholars say that's absolutely not true, because the whole way it's actually written is that she did it after they had sexual intercourse. And there is a law in Leviticus as well that says if you, once you've had sexual relations with your wife, you're unclean till sunset. So what most of them think is that she had to stay there until sunset and then go home in order to be ritually clean, which is kind of an odd thing. Now, I want to be very, very clear, as I'm going to show you, Bathsheba is not to blame in this situation at all. But it is an odd thing that, you know, this act of sin has taken place, but we have to make sure that we follow all our religious practices to make sure we're clean. And sometimes that's what the church can be like. You know, we can have massive sin happening in our hearts, but we got to make sure that we do all the right religious activities. If you think about, like, what I didn't include in those photos was the whole Catholic Church scandal. And so here, I just wanted to bring that up, this idea that she had to even stay there, go through this purification ritual, and then go home. Now, the first thing I want you to see, though, is that David stays home at a time when kings go off to war. The wording here is intentional. He sends Joab to lead the king's men. Whose men are they? Why did they write it that way? Right? They were also Joab's men. He was the military leader. But the author writes it, it's the king's men and the whole Israelite army. David is not where he's supposed to be. That's the first thing that is wrong here. David is home instead of with his army and with his men protecting Israel. He's not leading. He's not protecting his people. He's not fighting Israel's enemy. Instead, he is home napping, idle. And I have some grace for David. He's probably tired of fighting. He's fought all of his life. He fought Goliath when he was a young man. And he's won battle after battle after battle. And certainly I think he would feel at a certain point, I've earned the right to rest and to stop risking my life. Let other people fight the battle now. As king, I deserve to sit back here and maybe reap some of the spoils of my work and ministry, if you put it that way. But this is the pride of life in one sense, and also the sinful cravings. It's this desire for comfort over the calling that is in his life. And why we think he's napping is because it's evening. When he goes out onto the roof, it's not the middle of the night. It's evening. Bathsheba is not bathing in the middle of the night. She's bathing probably in the early evening. And so he's sleeping, which is not a sin in itself, but he's the king. And in the past, he would have been with his men and been part of protecting the country. So he's not where he's supposed to be. So he gets up from his nap. He's no longer tired. He goes out on his roof, and there he sees a beautiful woman bathing in her yard below. This is not, some people say, well, Bathsheba was bathing, and so she was enticing him. No, he's got the high ground, and she and all the courts in that day in the village would have been open. They didn't have roofs over them, and so she's in her yard doing what she's supposed to do. He's the one that's looking over top from the palace and sees her. So she is not trying to entice him in any way, but he sees her. And what he does is he doesn't, this is the first thing I want us to say. He doesn't look, what could have he done differently? What if you walk in and you're all of a sudden you realize this is terrible. But all of a sudden you realize, I've walked into this wrong bathroom, or I've walked into this wrong house that I thought was mine, and there's somebody there coming out of their, you turn away You purposefully turn your eyes. You give her privacy in some sense or another. He could have made a different choice, is my point. Sin and falling like these people have fallen is not an event that happens instantaneously. It's not like they're perfect and then suddenly they fall. It is a journey. Sin is a pathway. And one of the things I want us to understand as men and as the body of Christ is along that pathway, God is always giving you off-ramps. And he wants us. You see, he understands temptation. He knows that in one sense men are physically attracted by visual stimuli, visually attracted to women. And so he's saying, look, if you feel this, that's not a sin. Temptation is not a sin. Jesus was tempted in every way that we are, but did not sin. So when you see this, there's a choice for every man to make, or woman for that matter. I can continue down this path, or I can get on the off-ramp. And David chooses, I think, to continue down the path. He sees her. It doesn't really say it in the text, but in my opinion, he watches her for a while. Knowing men, that's probably what happened. So he chooses to feed the lust of the eyes. The lust of the eyes is what happens at this moment. And here, David can walk away at any time, but he chooses instead to watch. And because she's beautiful, he kind of becomes this voyeur, this, you know, lecher. He allows this thing in him to grow. And so, you know, at this point, what happens is it builds. As we don't take off ramps, both the level of our sin and ultimately the consequences that will come from it increase. You guys understand what I'm saying? So David here, what he does is he begins to watch her, and it leads to this place where he asks about her. And we might not even think that's another step, but it is, right? He's watching her, and he could have at that point, okay, I've watched her for a while. Ooh, this is not good. It's leading. There's an off-ramp. Let's just get out of here. And you know what? David had 19 combined wives and concubines that God allowed him to have. In one sense, that's one of the things eventually will say to him. This thing is cutting in and out. But Nathan eventually will confront him with, you have all of these wives and you need to go steal Uriah. So he has he has more than enough ways in which he can actually go and satisfy whatever urges are in him, and yet he chooses instead to find out who she is. I want to know who she is. And then one of his servants says, well, that's Uriah, the Hittite's wife. You know, something's going on here that I want to touch on. David has forgotten why God made him king. What is the purpose of leadership? It's this. It's the service for the good of the people of God and the glory of God. It is to serve God and God's people. That's his calling. And that's every leader's calling that was in these pictures. It is not to serve himself. It is not to feed his own ego. It is not to satisfy his desires. So like I said, what if when David saw Bathsheba, his first thought was, she is a child of God. My role and responsibility as the king is to do what is best for God's people. What if he had turned away and prayed? What if he had decided that
he should go to his own wives? What if Rabbi Zechariah or Brexicavia or any of the leaders mentioned right at the beginning when they first looked, they stopped themselves, like Job, who had said, I will make a covenant with my eyes to not look lustfully at a woman. What if they remembered who they are and why God called them? I am God's leader, and the reason God has called me to this and given me this platform is in order to protect and bless God's people and to help them flourish. What I'm getting at is when I look out here, excuse me, and I see Bathsheba, why didn't David say, and he found out even that it was Uriah's wife. And where was Uriah, if you know the story? He's at war protecting the kingdom. He's where David's supposed to be. And what if at that moment he had said, I can't do this? What if his heart was instead, as the leader of Israel, my job is actually to protect this family, to have this family flourish? Do you understand what I'm getting at? At some level, as leaders, if we forget who we are and why God gave us the platform in the first place, we forget our mission, we forget the ministry, I think this is part of what happens with these leaders. They're looking now, and instead of you being a child of God, who God has called me as the pastor of this church to help flourish, I should be caring about your marriage. Hello, church? My heart should be, when I look, I want your marriage to survive, to flourish. Not somehow, if I could get her. See, then I'm going to destroy my marriage, and I'm going to destroy your marriage and the ministry. So where does this happen? How does this happen where suddenly the whole purpose of ministry is gone? And David forgot, and I'm saying all of these other folks have forgot as well who they are. David sees her, he wants her, and so he escalates things. He goes further down the path. He sends someone to find out who she is, and then he also, when he finds out who she is, instead of going, oh my goodness, Uriah is actually at war, risking his life for the kingdom. You know, think about this, church. You know, how... See, he's got a choice here. Uriah is actually a faithful servant. And we're going to find out how faithful he is in a little bit. But he's a faithful servant of the kingdom and of David. And he's fighting for the nation. And then when David finds out that she's Uriah's husband, he doesn't think, oh my goodness, I have to honor Uriah and honor this family, and I got to turn away and stop all these bad thoughts. No, what he does is he says instead, and this is the enemy too, oh, her husband's not even here. Her husband's at war. How convenient. I don't have any husband that I have to worry about being there, stopping me from going and getting her. And so he sends people. And it says, to get her. In other words, he wasn't even saying, hey, do you want to come up here? You know, he's not even seducing her, really. He's taking his power position. And this is the next point, is leaders have ultimately a power position that is above this Bathsheba. David is the leader. And it's the same thing with all of these leaders. The problem often is they're counseling one of their people in their church, and the person looks at Rabbi Zechariah and thinks, oh my goodness, he's so wonderful. You know, and maybe, I want you to think about this. I'm going to get myself in so much trouble. But David has all the power, Bathsheba has none. He brings her to him, and it says that he
she comes to him. She has no choice in the matter. It's the king, for goodness sake. But it says that he just had sexual relationships with her. He just took her. Now, it doesn't say that he raped her, but it also doesn't say that she was consenting. It probably wasn't a violent thing, but what it was she has no power and he has all the power. And so she just submits to it. And all of these guys that did this stuff, they're the ones that have that power. And part of it is a dynamic. It's actually in 1 Timothy where Paul talks about the leaders that were abusing the widows. But he's also speaking to the widows. He's saying, look, you're vulnerable. And so part of what I want to do this morning is say to the women in this church, leadership people, don't think more highly of them than you ought to. As a woman, see, I do wonder a little bit, what if Bathsheba, and don't get me wrong, this is where I thought I was going to get in trouble, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying Bathsheba had, you know, was not the victim, but what if she had said to the king, this is wrong, no, how can you dishonor Uriah by even suggesting it? Now, I'm not blaming her at all. And I'm not saying that the women that get, you know, abused in these situations, it's their fault. It's very clear. Nathan says to David, when the prophecy comes, Bathsheba is like a little innocent lamb. You are the one who sinned. Okay? But I'm also saying to the women in the church right now, because oftentimes these guys get into relationships with these women and it goes on for years. And then when it finally comes out, they've been in this sexual relationship with the leader. At some point, I'm saying to the women in the church, you can shut it down too. Amen? You can shut it down too, and we need to be willing to do that. There is this power differential, though, that we need to see. He leverages his power, and then Bathsheba becomes pregnant. And this is when it really gets bad, because as this pathway down the sin pathway, and he hasn't taken any of his off-ramps. He could have taken another off-ramp, which was when he finds out who she is. He takes an off-ramp. Even when she came and he brought her too, he still has a choice before he actually has sex with her where he could have said, you go home, we're not doing this. He doesn't take that off-ramp. So then he commits the sin, but guess what happens? There's consequences. She's pregnant now. And this is not a love story. You know how many times in Hollywood they make this out to be a love story? This is not a love story. This is an abuse of power. It's the subjugation of Bathsheba, and she has no power. But it's also, she becomes pregnant, and she sends word to David, I'm pregnant, and I'm going to be in real trouble herself because Uriah's not around, so he'll know something happened. And that's when he has to. See, even at this point, David has a choice. I can confess, and it'll cost me. That's the off-ramp now. I can confess, and I can even tell Uriah when he comes that this is my fault. But it'll cost him. But what I want you to see is he tries to hide it and cover it up, and that's what happens with all these guys as well. Most people that are struggling in sexual sin, they cover it up. They hide it. All the time in the church, we find that. And, you know, even guys that are struggling with pornography, they usually don't tell anyone until their wife catches them. It's usually the consequence that causes them to want to get help. Do you understand what I'm saying? And there's a sense which all of these guys never came. If any of them at one point had come and just said, this is what's going on, before they got caught,
How much better would that have looked? Are you guys with me here? And so they don't. They hide it. And what happens for David is in the hiding of it, he's hatching plans. The first part of his plan is what? Bring Uriah here. And he kind of does this thing with Uriah where he's like, hey, how's it going at the front? You know, what's happening? How's Joab? Is he doing pretty good? And he's doing small talk with him. And then he says to him, hey, what you should do, you should go home and have a nice meal and spend some time with your wife. And it says that he even sent a gift to them. And I wonder what gift it was. Like, here's a bottle of my best Chablis. Go home. Have a couple of drinks with your wife. And what happens is he thinks, yay, now he'll sleep with his wife and then all my sin is covered up. But that's not what happens. What does Uriah do? He goes outside and he sleeps. And this is important. It says that he sleeps at the same place with all of David's other servants. What is Uriah saying? Servant, David. And I will not go and partake of the meal and sex with my wife and all these things. I'm not going to do it. Not while all of my brothers are at the front struggling and fighting. What's going on here? There's this contrast between Uriah's heart and David's heart. In one sense, Uriah is doing what David is supposed to be doing. His heart is for Israel. And what's David doing? David is actually partaking in what is only Uriah's to partake in. Do you see it? And Uriah won't. He doesn't go back and of course God is orchestrating this. Then it says that he actually brought him back again when he found out he didn't go home, and he gets him drunk. He gets him drunk hoping that he'll, you know, because then he'll want to go home and do his thing. And again, Uriah goes out, doesn't go home, and he again sleeps with the servants of David. And then finally, there's these off-ramps. Maybe what he should have done at that point is confessed. But whatever it is, in covering it up, it's escalating. The sin of the cover-up usually makes it so much worse. And so what he says then is, he sends Uriah back and he puts a sealed note with Uriah. He tells Uriah, you take this note back to give it to Joab. But he seals it so he won't read it. And what does the note say? I want you to make sure Uriah dies. And what's interesting, I won't look at the text because we don't have time, but what's interesting is that when Uriah reads the note and what he has to do in order to make sure that, or not Uriah, when Joab reads the note and he has to make sure that Uriah dies, what he does is he sends really close to the most secure and battle-hardened part of the city. He makes sure he sends him to the strongest defense area of the city that they're trying to take, and he makes sure that he sends them in close enough that the archers will be able to get them. Because we know that because he actually tells the person after Uriah dies, he tells them to go to David and say to David, you tell them that this has happened, but the problem is that many other people died. What I'm getting at is, like, it's not just Uriah. In order to make sure that Uriah died, they had to make, there was a bunch of collateral damage. And this is what happens when we don't take the off-ramps that God is giving to us. It's such a sad text. David, in his fear of losing his reputation, he commits a sin that has far worse consequences than
what it initially would have done if he would have just confessed. Let's end here. And what I want to do, I do want to talk a little bit next week about what God made the body for. And so it'll be kind of a continuation of this. But here's what my heart is, okay? Sin is a path. All of these folks that you've seen, they got on that path. And the problem isn't that they were tempted. The problem isn't even that they got on the path. The problem is they never took any of the off-ramps. Why didn't they take the off-ramps? You guys know? Because in their mind, the cost was too high. If people find out what I'm thinking, if people find out that I struggle the same as they do, if people find out that actually I've sinned in some way, then it'll hurt the ministry. And so I have to deal with it. I have to manage it myself. I have to do this myself. And what I want to happen in the church, if we're going to see revival, we have to, as the church, get better at talking about this. Don't you agree? See, the problem is there's a part of all of us that says, oh my goodness, sexual sin is so shameful, so dirty, so bad, that if I go and admit it to anybody that I've thought about this, or that I've actually looked at something I shouldn't have looked at, or if I've actually done something that I shouldn't have done, that they will reject me. And that keeps everything in the dark. And what I'm wanting us to become is a church where it's really safe. Because this stuff is not new. That's why the story of King David is there for us. It's not new. It's been part of humanity forever. But God is saying to us, guess what? You can be free. You can actually walk in freedom from this. But there is a pathway and there are off-ramps. But that off-ramp is actually hard. It is a hard thing to do, but it's meant to be confession. And confession is, we confess our sins, what? One to another. It's not standing up at the front and me shaming you, or all of us shaming you. It's not you telling the whole world all of your sinful thoughts and then you come down. It is, though, accountability. It's dealing with it. It's looking at it honestly. Hello? This is important, church, so if I'm taking more time with it, please give me grace. One, I haven't preached for a while. Two, I think we got to get this. Because it's happening rampantly. It's happening with the most anointed, gifted leaders. And they didn't start out that way. They didn't start out saying, I want to get into the ministry so that I abuse women. No, their heart was the kingdom of God. But it's along the way, the enemy wants to trap them. And all of these three things, the craving, the sinful cravings that we all struggle with, the lust of the eyes, and pride. And this is what I'm talking about, pride. Pride says, I can't admit my problem. I can't admit it. And I'm going to tell you right now, on the other side of admitting it, is freedom. On the other side of confession, as hard as it is, ultimately is freedom. But you have to have accountability wrapped up into that so it's real, so you're not just like, I confess my sins and I go out and do it again. No, I'm setting up real boundaries and all kinds of things that will help me to live this out. But at the same time, church, we need to be able to come to men. We need to be able to come together. You need to be able to
realize you can come to me and talk to me and not be afraid that, one, I'm going to expose it to the whole church, but I am going to say to you, let's set up real stop gaps in your life. But also, wives, I want you to understand, this is where I get myself in trouble again, but wives, I want you to also be able to do this. If your husband comes to you and say, you know what, I'm struggling with the light of the eyes, and I need you to help me, because your relationship with your husband is supposed to be this oneness. In one sense, you're supposed to be his best friend and the one he can have confidence, you know, be, confide in. And I know it's hard, and women are different than men generally. So I am saying that men with men, never ever should there be counseling with a man and a woman. And if you ever see me do that, you call me on it right away. But what I'm saying is, if you find out your husband has looked at something he shouldn't have, don't overreact to it either. Don't be like, that's it, the end of the marriage, you're gone, get out of my house, because that's exactly why he won't talk to you about it. Hello? Like, what I'm saying is, this stuff is there. It's underneath the surface of the whole church. And until we, as the body of Christ, start to talk about it, start to deal with it, start to pray for one another, start to have a safe way of confessing and holding each other accountable, then we're going to keep seeing this stuff happen over and over and over.